do everything they can to cloud defensive gun uses. And so I thought for our last segment here, it'd be perfect time to have John Lott on. John Lott is the president and founder of the Crime Prevention Research Center. His seminal work is More Guns, Less Crime. His latest book is The War on Guns, Arming Yourselves Against Gun Control Lies. That book is phenomenal. That book takes all of his earlier work, not only More Guns, Less Crime, but all of his earlier work. All of that contributes to that new book, and he gives it to you in bite-sized portions, is what I like to say. Very short chapters where you can find the topics that are important to you, read them, and grasp them. You need to read the whole book, don't get me wrong, but you can use it for reference after you've read it because everything is tight and bite-sized. No one understands self-defense gun uses like Lott. No one understands what more guns really do to crime like Lott. So I'm happy to have him with us. John, glad you're with us.
Oh, well, thanks very much for having me on, AWR. I appreciate it.
Well, why don't you talk to us a minute? Talk to us as if we're completely ignorant, John. Tell us, what does the defensive gun use landscape look like? What happens each year that the left tries so hard to hide from us? What do law-abiding citizens do with their guns?
Well, I mean, Sheriff Joe Arpaio's views are not unusual for police. You look at surveys of police, and you find that the vast majority of police officers are probably the strongest supporters that there are out there for private ownership of guns. And they realize that in many ways, private ownership of guns makes their job easier. I'll just give you one simple example, and that is take terrorist attacks. Police have a virtually impossible job to go and guard places where terrorist attacks might occur. You put somebody in uniform in front of a building or in front of some other target, it's like putting a neon sign on them saying, shoot me first, whether it be things like the Charlie Hebdo attack, or I can give you many attacks in the United States. If a police officer is there, they're going to be the first person that's going to be taken out. But terrorists have all sorts of strategic advantages by choosing the time and the place of the attack. Let's say you have a couple police officers on a bus and you have a terrorist there. If you also have concealed carry civilians there on the bus, though, it makes the job incredibly more difficult for the terrorist, because even if he wants to try to take out the police officers first, he doesn't know whether there's somebody behind him, to the side, or in front of him that he also has to worry about. And of course, even if the police leave, he still doesn't know who he has to go and worry about first. But the fact that there's civilians in those cases makes it less likely that the terrorist is going to go and shoot the police officers, because in the process of trying to shoot them, he will reveal who he is and where he's at and make himself vulnerable to civilians who might be able to go and stop him. But you know, you look generally at surveys of police. There's a survey done by Police One, which is the largest private organization of police in the country. They have about 380,000 active duty law enforcement full-time and about another 70,000 retired. And if you ask them whether private ownership of guns reduces crime, about 76% of the officers say that they're either extremely or very important reducing crime. Hmm. And so just in general, you know, whether it's people owning guns in their home or carrying it, problem that creates for the criminals is they don't know who it is that they have to worry about. I'll give you a simple example across countries. There's something called hot burglary rates. These are burglaries that occur while the residents are in the dwelling. In the United States, the hot burglary rate's about 13%. In a country like the UK, for example, it's 59%. The UK has a burglary rate twice the US rate. And when it occurs, almost 60% of the time, the people are in the home when the burglary occurs. Hmm. There's surveys that are done of burglars in different countries to ask them how long they spend casing a home before they break in. American burglars spend about twice as long casing a dwelling compared to their British counterparts. And we have this data for other countries. And there's a simple reason why they do that, is that they're worried about getting shot. And one way to try to make sure that they don't get shot is, if they do break in, make sure nobody's there in the home. The British burglars have no such fear. And, you know, you go and you try to pass what people might think are simple laws, like safe storage requirements that require people have to lock up their guns in their homes. Criminals respond to that. You see, when those laws get passed, criminals are more emboldened to attack people in their home, and they're more likely to attack when the residents are in their home, and they're more successful in committing their violent crimes against those individuals.
Huh. I've tried to stress that, John, at Breitbart, that when you demand, or mandate, I should say, when you mandate that a law-abiding citizen lock his or her gun up when at home, you're sending a signal to criminals. Hey, if you know where the gun owner lives, he or she is vulnerable the whole time they're in their home. And that's what you're touching on right now. They're vulnerable because, you know, they force us to lock up our guns under the guise of keeping children safe. But what it does in reality, it in turn exposes the whole family to violence, because now the adult gun owner can no longer use that weapon to defend his or her family.
Right. And you see the total number of deaths go up. Look, you can take the most recent year that we have data for. For children under age 15, there were 50 accidental gunshots in the United States. It may be great if it was zero, obviously, but people don't know the composition. We can't go and break it down the way we used to because of privacy considerations with the Centers for Disease Control data. But about a decade and a half ago, before they had those privacy rules, I was able to go through, look at the cases individually. And what you find is that over 60% of the shootings involving children are actually shots by adult males, usually in their mid to late 20s, who have criminal records, who it's very likely it's illegal for them to even possess a gun. And they very frequently have drug or alcohol problems. These are not normal, good people that are there in the vast majority of these cases. And to go and say, okay, we're going to mandate that people lock up their guns, for people it's not even legal for them to own guns, it's probably not going to have a big effect on them. And two, gun locks don't stop an adult male from accidentally firing his own gun.
Right.
It's just not relevant. These cases aren't young kids usually getting hold of guns and firing them. And so, you know, it's hard to think of any other item, I would argue, that's as commonly owned in American homes that has as few accidental deaths that are associated with it as you do guns. And I would just argue that people are behaving extremely responsibly, and to go and have a rule that's kind of one size fits all, where everybody's mandated to lock up their guns. If you live in a high crime urban neighborhood, that may not be the brightest thing to go and do. It may be much more important to be able to get quick access to a gun in order to defend yourself and your family than any possible reduction that you're going to have in the risks associated with the gun being owned in the home there.
Huh. I know you're right, John. I mean, as you're talking, and I always go here in my mind, I think about the single mom. The single mom who might be in a high crime inner city, be it Chicago, be it Baltimore, be it St. Louis. I mean, on and on we could go. That 38 special and quick access to it may be all that can keep those three or four kids that live with her safe. Those three or four kids to whom she is a mother, and there's no father figure. The only thing keeping them safe is that 38 special. And when the liberals come in, and they mandate, as we've already covered, storage requirements for guns, they basically take away that mother's ability to use that gun to defend those children. They lay them open. They make them prey for predators by doing that. I'm not saying they do it with that thought. I'm not putting words in their mouth. I'm saying that's the outworking of what they do. That's what your work shows.
Right. Well, look, you have a situation where if you follow the advice of gun control advocates, you're supposed to store the gun and the ammunition separately. You're supposed to keep the key in a completely separate place. You know, you're making it a substantial effort and a period of time for somebody to be able to go and get the ammunition, get the gun, put the ammunition in the gun, and be ready to go and use it. People may not have the luxury of that type of time to be able to go and make the gun operable, for them to defend themselves and their families. And so my point of view would be, look, if you were to go and ask people how many accidental gun deaths do they think are actually occurring in the United States each year involving children? When I've asked people that, they have numbers that are, 10 times or more higher than the actual number is.
Right.
And so, it appears that even ask them how many accidental gun deaths would there be if you had your ideal safety rules, and they usually guess a number that's higher than the current number is.
Right.
And so I think that goes a long ways to showing that people are a lot more responsible than gun control advocates give them credit for, and they exaggerate the problem that's there. And that exaggeration, if they get their way, will actually lead to more deaths and more harm.
Well, John, for my last question to you, I want to switch a little bit, not switch out of your sweet spot, but I just want to switch your work on the benefit of shall issue versus may issue. That has always been, to me, of great importance. Your emphasis on the benefit of states that have shall issue concealed carry permits versus may issue concealed carry permits. And would you explain to listeners, and again, treat us like we're dumb, be rudimentary. What's the difference between may issue and shall issue? And after you explain that, please tell us, what is the benefit of one over the other?
Sure. Well, the difference between the two is pretty simple. One is, do you have objective rules that once you meet, you can go and get a concealed carry permit? So you're a certain age, you pass a criminal background check, you do whatever training's required, and you pay your fee. But once you've met those criteria and you're in a right to carry or a shall issue state, names are used interchangeably, you're allowed to be able to go and get a concealed carry permit to carry. In may issue states, you may have those rules, but then in addition, you have to demonstrate to some third party, a judge or a sheriff or a police department, that you have quote unquote good reason for getting a concealed handgun permit. And in those places, the number of people with get permits is very small. Los Angeles County, you may have 240 people out of 8.5 million adults that get a concealed carry permitted. In New York City, John Stossel, I guess a couple years ago, had been getting lots of death threats, applied for a concealed carry permit, spent something like over $800, went to the police station multiple times for interviews, filled out the forms, took the required class that he had to do, but yet he was denied. And the police in New York City said, well, it was true, he had lots of death threats, and some of them seemed very serious. The police department had decided that none of the threats rose to a sufficiently significant level that they thought that he deserved to be able to carry a concealed carry permit. But of course, there are other people, labor union chiefs, people who are maybe politically connected in the right way, that they did approve for getting permits. So you have a lot of arbitrariness, and you also make it so that the people who are most likely to be victims of crime, poor blacks, for example, who live in high crime urban areas of New York or Los Angeles or other places, there's no chance they're going to get a permit. You look
Right.
at areas in Watts or in Harlem, nobody gets a concealed carry permit issued to them in those places. I'm glad politically powerful or wealthy individuals are able to go and defend themselves, but they're not the ones who are most likely to be victims of violent crime. And so, if you're going to get a big benefit, you want to make sure that the most likely victims are the ones who are going to be able to defend themselves. So, but even in these so-called right to carry or shall issue laws, there's big differences that exist. So in a state like Illinois, you have to have 16 hours of training, have a $150 permit. The cost of being able to go and get a concealed carry permit can run you at least $450. By contrast, in Pennsylvania, it costs $19, the whole cost of getting a concealed carry permit. The difference is that when you're talking about $450, the very people, again, that my research indicates to me benefit the most from getting a concealed carry permit, poor blacks who live in high crime urban areas, who do they think gets priced out of having that option to protect themselves?
Right.
Of course, those are going to be the ones that have that problem.
Well, this
and, you know, there's lots of laws that we can go through, but I've become convinced over time that gun control advocates fight for these things in the particular ways that they do in order to make sure that the most vulnerable people, the people who are most likely to be victims of violent crime, are the ones who are prevented from owning guns.
Right. Yeah, that goes to a point I've made again and again, that gun control doesn't make the vulnerable less vulnerable, it makes the vulnerable more so. And
right.
And it does that. You're making the point, John, so perfectly. These gun control laws, even when you're just looking at the difference between shall issue and may issue, these laws, they put poor people, whether black or white, but I know poor blacks in a lot of inner cities, but they put poor people in general at a disadvantage. These laws deny them the ability to exercise a right. They may even know they have the right. They can't afford to exercise it because of the laws that Democrats have put in place in certain states.
The Obama administration claims that up to about 80% of crime in the United States is gang-related, and that the vast majority of that is drug gang-related. If I could click my fingers right now and magically cause all illegal drugs to disappear and all guns, how long do you think it would be before illegal drugs started coming back into the United States? If you're in a place like El Paso, maybe 20 minutes, a half hour. The thing that people have to understand is that at the very time they bring in the illegal drugs, they're going to bring in guns in order to protect that valuable property. It's not like the gangs can go to the police and say, look, this other gang stole our drugs. Can you help get them back? And so they have to set up their own militaries, essentially, in order to protect that valuable property that they have. And, you know, the notion that somehow you're going to be successful from stopping bad guys from getting guns is just as likely as you think you're going to be able to stop bad guys from being able to go and buy illegal drugs. The
right.
Same sources that sell illegal drugs are the same ones that sell illegal guns. And if it's no more difficult to smuggle guns in along with the drugs that they smuggle into the United States. And they have to do it if they're going to protect the extremely valuable property that they have. And so all this notion about background checks or what have you, there's a reason why these things don't work. And that is, even if you kind of close off what you think may be an obvious way for people to go and get guns right now, there's so many other ways that are there that are just extremely difficult to try to close off.
Huh. Well, John, I can't tell you, man, what a great honor to have you here. I always enjoy your friendship, of course, but to have you share this with our listeners at Breitbart, you have a grasp on this that very few people have. And I certainly want to get you back to discuss some other aspects of this in depth. And again, listeners, John's new book, The War on Guns, Arming Yourselves Against Gun Control Lies, you've got to pick the book up. It is a book you read. You read it through, you benefit from that, but then you keep the book and you use it as reference because the chapters are bite-sized, and John gives you things in a way you can grasp it quick, and you're armed. You're armed not simply to argue with people who are pro-gun control, and I mean argue in a beneficial way. You're not simply armed for that, but you're armed mentally to understand the lies that are being pushed daily here. So, John, thank you for being with us. I appreciate it. This has been Bullets with AWR Hawkins, a Breitbart News podcast brought to you by PodcastOne.com.